Welcome to the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast.
Hey everyone, it's the Oxley Bomb podcast live from Valencia, the last race of the season. We can all have a little cry together if you want. We'll do that later. We'll have a little group hug and a group cry. It's me, Matt Oxley, as always, old journalist, old racer, and my podcast partner.
Peter Bomb, not an old racer, not an old, a young journalist actually, always data recording, always in the paddock, sometimes crew chief, and yeah, that's it.
Cool. And first of all, what we want to say is that I'm sat in the Valencia Media Center, surrounded by noisy journalists and photographers who are all delighted that the season is over and they're about to go home. So if there is any background noise, don't blame it on us, blame it on them. So first of all, you know, we have to say massive congratulations to Pecco Bagnaia for winning. You know, this is the 75th season of Grand Prix Motorcycle World Championships, and without a doubt, it's the hardest because there were 42 races. You know, the first World Championship, there were six in 1949. There were 42 races, which is absolutely insane. And to me, you know, the reason, obviously, Pecco Bagnaia is, he's got a superb riding talent and he's very smooth and, you know, he kind of makes it look easy, really, doesn't he? But what really made him, the difference for him, to me, is his ability to keep focus and to keep cool under pressure and to keep that going for, what, 7-8 months. I mean, you know, he seemed to lose his cool a little bit here on Friday, but that, apart from that,
most Fridays, a lot.
you're right. But wow, I mean, you just have to say, well done, Pecco, you're a genius, because to come out of 42 races, wow, toughest ever season, and you know, beat Jorge Martin was a hell of an achievement. Okay, so he's on this best bike, he's riding for the best team, but you know, so is N.A. Bastianini. You know, luck can happen, bad luck can happen. What did you think of his season, Peter?
I'm very happy with this world champion because it's so deserved. It's really, really deserved. It's a very interesting person. Let's first say, by defending a title is harder, you know, people say, but it is really, really is true. And now we arrived here in this last race with only 14 points. I think last year was over 20 or something, and it was just, you know, nothing. So he's a very complete rider in a team on the best bikes, in a very, very good team. Be careful what I'm saying. He's the world champion, but he is not the most talented guy on the grid, I think. And then I'm not only referring to Marc Marquez, because that's next level, but he is, other than that, he's very, very complete. And having a long season with so many races and extra race on Saturday in it, it helps being very complete, because you might not win everything, but you very seldom throw everything away. And that's exactly what he did. He had a couple of typical Pecco things, like leading fairly early and throwing it away, but not too many. So yeah, he's a very complete rider. He's also a nice representative of a guy that represents the motorsport. So no problems at all. I loved the whole championship as it went over the last couple of months, because the opponent, Jorge Martin, is a complete opposite guy, you know. You and me, we call him a cage fighter, so it can't be any more different than that, that it goes between these two guys until the last round is already beautiful. The way it went today was quite spectacular, but I can live very, very well with Pecco Bagnaia as the world champion, fully deserved.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He rode a genius season, you know. He just had everything worked out, and you know, MotoGP is so complicated and so high stress now that talent is just, well, it's still a big thing, but you know, there's so many other things going on. The racing is the bikes are so complicated, the racing is so high pressure, the amount of races, so on and so forth. So you know, big up to Pecco, he did a great job, and I think, you know, next year we've got lots to look forward to. The race itself, I mean, you know, one, for a minute it looked like we were going to have a KTM 1-2, didn't it? And then Binder sort of took a voluntarily one lap, long lap penalty for running wide. I was sort of thinking maybe he did something last night that he shouldn't have done, and I thought, I must give myself a long lap penalty. But no, he just ran wide. It's easy to do. You outbrake yourself. You come through turn 10, which is pretty sketchy, which is where Miller crashed a little bit later, I think it was. You know, it's a sketchy place. And when, you know, we've had a lot of crashes at turn 10, which is where Miller went down, because you're flicking from the right to the left, and it's a fast corner, so you're not braking, you're not transferring load onto the front tire, and so there's not a lot of, you don't have a lot of grip, and it's a late start to the race, 3 p.m. We're in the autumn here, the sun is already starting to go down, and without a doubt the temperature was dropping. We saw several guys crash around that time because the temperature was dropping. They'd chosen the hard front, which was the right tire, but a couple of degrees cooler and easy to crash.
This remembers me of something we already years ago, because I've been in Valencia. Every time I go there, I try to do the counting, but it must be like 30, 40 times probably even in my life. And one thing we learned in whatever team I was, when you're winter testing there, and this is basically your winter test time, after 3:30, you need to be really, really careful. Even when the track temperature, when you measure it, is still okay. Probably it's the angle of the sun to the tarmac. Something changes, and then it's turn 8 and turn 11 where they start to lose the front.
Yeah.
I mean, we have destroyed some expensive stuff there in the last part of the testing days. Valencia is very, very specific. And even with the new tarmac, it has a different character. And yeah, it caught people out, caught a lot of people out. So it was an expensive thing to have the race that late. That made me even, I don't know if you heard it as well, Pekka Maijala said in his debrief that at some point while he was leading the race, probably to his own big surprise, he realized that he didn't like the front pressure, which was translated by me into it was still too low.
Yeah.
Not only too low being illegal, but also too low for full confidence. It was moving too much underneath him. So we look back, see two KTM say, okay, after you guys. He heats up his front tire deliberately, getting back to good feeling. And well, the KTMs took care of themselves. He didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
And he wins the race. So that's a special kind of cleverness.
Exactly.
With all the pressure. Good.
That's what makes him different, his focus and his coolness and his intelligence, that he can just get behind those two bikes, use their heat to warm up his front tire and then go again. I mean, wow. I mean, that's just to kind of, as if racing isn't complicated enough as it is, to have to kind of factor that kind of stuff into it is ridiculous. And obviously the point, the crazy thing about the tire rule, to avoid going over pressure, they have to start way below the legal limit, which is supposed to be dangerous, but it isn't.
We are admiring now his thinking, but we shouldn't admiring that it's crap that you need to do that. It's bad news. I mean,
of course, that's to us. It's not.
You shouldn't be doing that.
I was speaking to an engineer today. He said it's no longer motorsport; it's gambling. You have to gamble with your front pressure. While speaking about the KTMs, we should also mention, the stewards. While we're moaning about the people in charge, the stewards, where Brad Binder, he barged into Alex Marquez, didn't he? So he got he got to drop one position, quite rightly, and he overtook Vinales, and then instead dropped one position. They said that's okay. So it was like, what? Insane.
Everybody was tired, mechanic riders, but the race direction was very tired today as well. That's completely not possible. No.
I think they were watching some Mickey Mouse cartoons or something like that. It was very strange, very strange. And obviously, going on from that, the tire pressure rules. So poor old Fabio Di Giantonio loses third place and gets fourth instead. And Brad Binder's promoted up third because Di Giantonio's tire was under pressure for the second time. So, that's a bloody nightmare. And I was speaking to a crew chief a couple of days ago. And he said they've been winning races for years on low 1.8, maybe 1.8. to 1.83 and the limit is 1.88. So this whole thing, anyway, that's enough about tire pressure. Let's stop talking about tire pressure.
I have a question for you, Matt. So Giantonio gets the champagne, gets the prize, goes to his camper, puts it in front of the television, and later this night somebody knocks on his door, hey man, that's probably mine. Is that really, I mean, that must be funny. No, I don't give it. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, no.
It's another fight.
Well, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't give it away. Funnily enough, this...
to fight for it.
Funnily enough, this brings back a memory. I was doing a feature with Jeremy Burgess when he was working with Valentino Rossi in Donington in 2003. And Rossi had won the race. He was on the podium, more certainly, and he got the trophy and everything. And then he got a 5-second penalty for overtaking under yellow flags, a 10-second penalty. So he lost,
he lost
the place. And that came over the tannoy. And I was sat at the back of their truck with Alex Briggs, his mechanic, and a few other people. And they just grabbed the trophy and hid it somewhere. the track. Right. so that they couldn't give it back. And I just thought that was brilliant, you know. So then we go on to we need to talk about Jorge Martin because, wow, you know, I mean, we love Martin because, you know, he's a warrior and I like warriors. And, you know, Pecco Bagnaia is just like the perfect gentleman. Like when he climbed the podium in Qatar, the first thing he did was go and kiss Nadia Pavadini, sorry, the Grazini boss, give her a peck on both cheeks. So, you know, what a gent. Whereas Martin is this just fucking, you know, crazy mofo kind of, you know, he's going to chew your head off if you do the wrong thing. And it's just been so lovely. I just love watching him screw the maximum out of a motorcycle. He's just like, just like an animal. I love that.
You respect Martin, but you sort of, I admire basically what Martin is doing and have the respect for Pecco Bagnaia. It's a different response that I get, but they're both brilliant in their own ways. The way Jorge was yesterday was unbelievable. And today, it's hard to say. Let me get to the first incident that happened because he did an amazing start. It's easy to forget it. Eh?
Yep.
Bagnaia was on pole. He was not on pole position, but he had the first position given because Vinales was naughty or not the cleverest guy in the warm-up. So, and he's already a good starter. So Bagnaia did what Bagnaia needed to do, but Jorge Martin immediately slots. I see the restart a couple of times. He was aggressive, but also very smart. How he exited turn one, how he prepared turn two, immediately second. And it looked like he did an early, I think it was the beginning of lap three, that he was nearly running into the back of Bagnaia in the braking for turn one. So that looked like an over-enthusiastic move, and it put him wide and back onto P8 or something, whatever. Did you see how he came back on the race line, actually?
Yeah.
That was fully fucking aggressive. But anyway, looking back at that action, it's more or less, if I have to point the finger at somebody, it's Ducati with all the arrow. What happened is Bagnaia didn't have the best of drive out of the last corner. The last corner, all the time what Pecco did, whoever was behind him was braking incredibly late for the last corner, missing the apex completely, but trusting his acceleration from his Ducati and his gift to use that, and then he can't be passed. But he missed a little bit the acceleration. Jorge Martin found himself way too close up to Pecco Bagnaia, but he didn't want to do it. He went out of the slipstream to cool himself, went back in it, because at some point you need to go to the right under the braking, and suddenly he got sucked into it. So yeah, that sucked. But for me, it didn't look like an over-enthusiast attempt to overtake Pecco Bagnaia, not that. But when he came back in, slotted in as P7 or 8, he got the red mist, and it was back to Moto3 years again, and it didn't last very long from there on.
And I mean,
slicing through the pack, eh?
Yeah. But the thing that's important to me is that this is two races in a row that we've had, and it doesn't matter whether it's the leaders or whoever, but they're the people we see. You know, this is happening all the time down through the pack. Due to these vacuum behind the Ducati, or the Aprilia is the same, basically the better the aero you have, the bigger the vacuum you leave behind. So that makes it harder for the rider who gets into the vacuum. Stop, it's very, very dangerous, because, you know, riders say that, you know, they get into that vacuum and it feels like they're accelerating. You know, they're not, but the guy in front is braking and then they're not decelerating enough. So they're charging towards his back wheel, and then they're trying to brake more, but then they're locking the front tire. So, you know, you could not imagine a more dangerous situation. And we've had that twice in a row. We had it with Pecco and Tar, and we had it with Martin and Pecco here. And
that was just as close. Eh?
And the irony, of course, is that this all this Ducati aero.
It's Ducati's fault.
That's causing this problem, and they're going to bloody hurt or worse one of their riders because of their aero. So, you know, that annoys the hell out of me. Yeah, I mean, that was a very, very scary moment. Very, very scary.
The mistake of Jorge Martin shortly later into Marc Marquez, okay, that was a bit overdone. But when I try to think for him, it was quite hectic around him. And there was a good fight, a proper struggle, a proper fight between Zarco and Marc Marquez. And he saw that right in front of him. And he saw that Marc Marquez was getting boxed around a little bit by Zarco. It's easy to forget that, eh?
Yeah.
But Zarco did some proper moves on it. Usually when a rider gets pushed offline one corner, it takes him 2-3 corners to get back into his real serious position on the track. So you can profit from that. If somebody gets pushed around a little bit offline, you have to immediately put your wheel underneath him in the next corner, because it's open, it's there. So Marc was just boxed around a little bit, and that made Jorge a little bit extra enthusiastic to try a dive into turn four. And turn four, is turn four. It's the first right-hander after a couple of times going left. It's a lower track temperature, and it's also a corner that has banking. And what happens with banking is that you don't really need to make the apex perfectly. So into turn four, riders, when they are usually, I think most of the riders, not even 50% of the times, hit the apex there properly, because you can afford to not hit it properly and still have a really good lap time and a good exit. So when you see the opportunity coming to dive underneath him, you usually do it at turn four, because 50% of the time the guy in front of you is not coming back completely to the curb. Well, Mark was coming back completely to the curb, and the rest is history. What I was negatively surprised is Jorge Bagnaia. But I haven't, the cameras didn't show everything, but from what I could see, and this, the time, how the time went on, I don't think he went back to Mark to check on Mark, which is actually not only just a gentleman thing to do, but in this case, the normal thing to do. Remember how Mark was all over Miguel Oliveira in Portimao when he knew he hit him and it was his fault. This was Jorge's fault, and Mark went really, really high. So it's the fact that he didn't do that is registered somewhere in Mark's mind for next year, I tell you.
Yeah. And this is an important thing to remember, that all these riders, they have memories like elephants, and that if somebody screws them over, they do not forget. And, we saw it earlier in the race with Mark and Bezzecchi colliding. I mean, Mark went up the inside on the first lap, up the inside of turn two, took out Bezzecchi. And yeah, it was Mark's fault. But, you know, and Bezzecchi was raging about it after the race. He says he's, Mark's the dirtiest rider, and he never gets a penalty because he's Mark Marquez. And I nearly said to him, well, yeah, it used to be Rossi that was like that, you know. But anyway, I didn't.
Not a good moment.
No. So he was like, that he went to see Marquez, he went to speak to Carlos and Espeleta, and he didn't want to talk about it and blah, blah, blah. And then we spoke to Mark about it later, and he said, well, I don't even want to talk about this because Marco's put me out so many times this year, I can't even remember. So wow, Bezzecchi.
It's already heating up, for next year.
Yeah. Bezzecchi and Marquez are already at.
Yeah, but this was bound to happen, sure. Matt, because they are the same type of warriors
exactly,
on the bike.
Exactly.
They can accept very, very, normally they can accept very, very well. They don't cry, they don't complain, because they also are hard to others, so they don't complain. But the fact that Bezzecchi was complaining can be either it was really a bit of a move that's really, really dirty, even in their eyes, or just like race direction and many riders, especially many mechanics, is also very, very tired. And I think this is the last thing. Marco normally never crash.
No, I mean, yeah, definitely sort of daggers drawn already for next year. They're absolutely 100%. And you were saying that they're the same people, and they are. And that's exactly why Marquez and Rossi clashed so much, because they're the same riders. You know.
It was bound to happen.
It was just bound to happen. They're just too similar. You know, they just don't give anybody any room. And which brings me back to, there was a lot of talk before the race that, Bagnaia is going to benefit from the help of VR46 riders, blah, blah, blah. And yesterday in the sprint, DiGiantonio obviously had more speed than him and didn't overtake. And people were saying, why didn't he overtake? He should have overtaken. Well, obviously, DiGiantonio is in line to take Luca Marini's ride for next year. So what does he want? An extra point this year, or a ride or a job next year? I mean, it's, you don't have to be a genius.
That was it, yeah.
You don't have to be a genius. Yeah. But, there's all kinds of... So everybody says, well, that's not right. It's kind of team orders are bad. But A, it wasn't team orders. It was more to do with the contract. There was no order. But riders are like this. They will attack or not attack rivals for all kinds of reasons. They will attack a rival because, I remember he screwed me at Mugello back in June at turn five. Or even...
He pissed in my helmet.
Yeah. Or he screwed me at Sachsenring in 2019. They don't forget. So I'm going to have him. Or even, I don't like him because I just don't like him. Or, he tried to sleep with my girlfriend last weekend. Or he tried to sleep with my sister 2 months ago. So there's all these little sort of revenge things building up in their brains all the time. And you have to remember that there's a multifarious reasons why riders either attack or they don't attack. It's like, Marquez not attacking Martin in Qatar last week. You know, what's the point? You know, there's a guy fighting for the world championship and you're going to get a point or two extra. There's no point. Just leave it, you know, unless you hate the guy. You know, so
so until yesterday, Mark didn't hate Martin. Now, hate is maybe a big word, but
yeah, you might be right.
Maybe they're already texting and hugging, whatever. Yeah, but yeah, it looked nasty to me.
It was funny after the race for all the debriefs. All the riders come up to the media center for the debriefs, and there was so much hugging going on. It was hilarious, which is kind of nice to see, actually. You know, all the riders giving each other a big hug. It's the end of the season. You're kind of allowed to hug each other at the end of the season, aren't you? You know, I don't think they do it very often. Apart from that,
I'm not going to hug you.
No. Come on, Peter left last night or was it this morning? I can't remember.
I flew this morning in time to see the race at home in Holland. A weird experience.
And we did have a hug before we left, so you know, don't deny that.
Okay.
So yeah, all in all, here we go. End of the season. End of my 36th season in Grand Prix, and it's been pretty cool. There's been some great moments. You know, it's very much a Ducati championship, but you know, some people get worked up about that. It doesn't bother me that much, to be honest. You know, all I want is good racing. You know, I don't really. I mean, of course you want a mix of motorcycles, but, you know, if the racing's good and they're all on Ducatis, then it brings in a different kind of...
Are you sure you're in the media center, Matt? There's a lot of extra noise going around.
It's Gareth and David from Golden Goose Photography making lots of noise.
Is this the opposition trying to sabotage us? I see that as a compliment.
They're packing up their cameras and doing stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. So I'm blaming them. I think it's quietened down. Sorry for the noise, everyone. I think they're going. I'm going to meet them for dinner in about an hour, I hope, and have one or two glasses of wine, let's say. So here we are. It's Sunday night and we have one day off and then the next season starts. So the next season starts at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning. And I can't remember ever having been a bigger changeover of riders. We've got Johann Zarco on a Honda on Tuesday. We've got Luca Marini on a Honda, even though that's not official, but we know it's going to happen. We've got Franco Morbidelli on the Pramac Ducati. We've got Alex Rins on the factory Yamaha. And last but not least, we've got Marquez on a Grazini Ducati. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 big names all changing, which that doesn't happen very often.
No. Putting a small guy like Mark on a Ducati is not a big job because Martin is also not the biggest, but putting Luca Marini on a Ducati.
On a Honda, you mean?
I mean, they have to bring out the grinder and welding and whatever to do because that guy is huge. And you cannot just say, okay, we remove the back of the seat hump and there you go. No. It's all about the balance. It's handlebars. It's fuel tanks and the whole thing, you know. So I'm curious, but maybe he already tried it secretly. If it fits him, if he likes it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that Marquez hasn't already sat on the Ducati. If you think back to the Rossi years when he signed with Honda at the end of 1999 to join Honda in the 500 class at Phillip Island at like 11 at night or midnight, he sneaked into the Honda pit and sat on the NSR 500 and Jeremy Burgess showed him around it and said this is this and that's that. So, yeah.
Same with Yamaha. When he went to Yamaha, he also had the same.
He did exactly the same when he did to the Yamaha. Waited till it was late at night, sneaked into the Yamaha garage, and they showed him around the bike and everything, and he sat on it and so on. So I cannot believe that Marc Marquez has not done the same. I don't think he would have gone to Bologna, because I think he wouldn't have been able to hide that. That would have got out, wouldn't it? And obviously that wouldn't have been cool. But I cannot believe that he has not sneaked into the Grazini Ducati either this weekend or last weekend or the weekend before and sat on the bike and maybe said, I need this and I need that. And Peter, you were talking about how all the Ducati riders, we think, have tailored seats, not seats, tanks. Well, yeah. Tanks and seats. So their ergonomics of the bike are completely individually tailored to each rider, because that is so important. As you were saying last time,
it looked the same, but no fuel tank cover is the same. They're all different. The position, the handlebars on the etc. They're all sometimes major differences. You can see it.
Yeah.
Sometimes very small, but they're all, and And it's so important at the moment where you put the rider exactly, where you put the center of gravity, keep it where you want to have it, because then all the calculations make sense. But also in a way that the rider doesn't get tired. You have to have these couple of seconds on the straights or in between the corners that you just can chill out a little bit, but at the same time can move in the way that is needed at the moment. Because these riders, they're moving their body so quickly, they need to be able to very quickly and at the same time very, very smoothly move the weight over the bike. And that has a lot to do, we call it ergonomic, you know, it's how you can basically, they hold on to the handlebars and more or less stand on the foot pegs.
Yeah.
And the seat, it's maybe to put, you know, really, they use the far end of the seat by the time the bike is really upright. But before that, it's all moving with these four contact points. They're moving swiftly around it and using their weight over these four contact points. And that's so important at the moment. It's not just luxury or having less wind resistance. That's not the thing. There's a lot of goals to be reached with seating positions nowadays. Remember Jorge Lorenzo, Ducati.
Yeah.
I know it was hyped up a little bit, but he realized that he was the guy that, coming from old school bikes, learned that, okay, and the reason is he was not the fittest, not at all. He hated the gym. So he found out that on a Ducati with all the aero, the braking is done now in a shorter time, means he has to how do you say this in English? Anyway, the way he holds on to the handlebars with his body, the way he controls that he's not flying off the bike, he needed too much force for that. So he started to ask for all sorts of helps. And that's how it all started. We were laughing at it at the time. But in the end, now they're all having individually tailor-made fuel tanks and covers. Remember, the Suzukis had even supports for the rider's knee. So it is a thing. It is a thing. And the reason is we're braking harder. Point.
Yeah. I mean, when Lorenzo won his first race on the Ducati at Mugello in 2018, that's when they gave him that horrible bulbous tank kind of extension so that he could basically, you know, load his lower body against that. So he had that to brake with as well as his wrists. And a couple of the last times I tested Grand Prix bikes, like a fight when I was used to ride 500s and 250s at the end of the year, just to give people a slight exaggeration. So this is more than 30 years ago. You know, I was testing Doohan's bike at Barcelona, and you know, you go around and the brakes aren't warming up. You've got carbon brakes and they aren't warming up that great. So you come up to a corner and you think, well, I'll see if I can get some heat into them, and you grab the brake and so suddenly the brakes come up to hit to full.
The bad old days of carbon, eh? No brakes, too much brake, yeah.
And because I wasn't race fit, I actually went over the handlebars. I just literally flew over the handlebars. So I was still holding onto the bike with my hands, but I was looking at his number one plate, upside down, yeah? And thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a really big crash. And then sort of obviously let go of the brake and fell back down into the seat. And I did the same with Max Biaggi's 250 at Mugello. And it was about that time where I thought, you know what, I think I've had enough of testing these bikes.
I prefer the microphone instead of the brake lever.
Exactly. And, you know, people have to realize that the brake, you know, they're getting towards 2G on the brakes. This is incredible. And so they need to completely lock themselves in position, not only with their wrists, but also with their crotch by grabbing the tank, and with their knees, and also with their feet by really digging into the foot pegs. Because, like I say, the whole, you know, they won't feel it because they're so strong and so used to it. But if they weren't, if you or I got on one of those bikes and tried to brake like they do, we would go...
Speak for yourself.
We would go flying over the handlebars.
Yeah, no way. So for sure, with all the testing that starts on Tuesday, there's a lot of extra boxes in almost all the trucks to be prepared for everything that the rider wants. And what I learned, I never was in GP, but in all other classes, is there is, and that's also interesting, there's a huge difference in what the rider thinks he needs when he sits on the bike the first time in the box, and how you finally end up after a couple of days testing. Yeah. You know, the mechanics go crazy. The lever bar up and the brake lever up and down, and the brake pedal up and down, and the foot pegs here and there in the box all night long. You're playing with it until he's really, really thinks that he's happy. He comes back after two laps, impossible to ride. Okay, well, and you might even end up more or less where you were offering it him the night before. So I had a couple of long nights, actually, speaking of Valencia, because usually until a couple of years ago, Monday was already Moto2, Moto3 test. So from Sunday to Monday, usually there was a big change. I either go to a complete new team, change the shirt and see my bike and my rider officially for the first time, or you put Sunday after race your bikes back into the truck take out the new ones or the new sashi. That was the hardest thing, another sashi, and then have to work all night long to build new bikes. If you go to, you know, from Kalex to Sutro or Backwards or whatever, you know, that's a full all night job in at our team at that time, because we didn't have four bikes. We had two bikes and we were building all night long. So when you 4 o'clock can go to the couch to sleep 1 or 2 hours, that was a luxury, actually.
Yeah. This is why I'm a journalist. It's much easier. Going back to Marquez on the Ducati as well, like I say, I find it hard to believe that he hasn't sneaked into the Grazini box at some point, which isn't hard to do if you do it at night when, you know, there's nobody around, really. It is not at all hard to do. And if he's done that, then Ducati will have taken photographs and all that kind of stuff. And they would have fed that into programs to kind of work out where he needs to sit on the bike and blah, 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 blah. So I'm sure, because, you know, if they don't do that, then they'll waste the whole of tomorrow buggering around with riding position and everything, you know, whereas if
Mark will be not so difficult. He is small, but Martin is more or less the same size. I'm worried for Luca Marini on the Honda.
Yeah.
That's another challenge.
Well, you never know. Maybe it'll bloody...
I'm worried for him for many reasons, not just for cheating, also for riding. Because look at the rider this weekend when we speak about Honda. Everybody, I mean, Alex Rins, he didn't really want to set the world on fire this weekend. He just want to survive it. And still he crashes twice in the race and on Friday morning. That Honda is not giving you a lot of warning.
No.
It's actually probably only working when you're nearly crashing and have a feel for that limit, because it's impossible how people keep crashing with them.
Yeah.
Mark. He knows when he can crash and does crash and learn from it, and he also knows when it's a weekend not to crash. So
yeah.
Okay, but the Mark is another podcast.
I kind of wonder, I mean, Marquez's crash today wasn't his fault, was his 29th of the season, so that's his record. And I just have a feeling that one of the reasons why the Hondas just crash now, even more than they've ever done, is because of the tire pressure rule, you know. So maybe they, you know, if they're going slightly too high, because, you know, Honda, the Japanese factories tend to be the most rule-abiding, let's say. So they're probably running their front tires higher than most other people. And the Honda's already got an iffy front end. And if you add in a slightly overpressure front tire, it's going to be unrideable, isn't it? So I sort of wonder...
If you say it like that, yeah. It's a bike that all the lap time from the Honda comes from the front tire.
Yeah.
It's all about being able to be impossibly late on the brakes and still turning in with the fork completely bottoming and the front tire deforming. And if you don't do that, you crash. And if you do it, you're really, really fast.
Yeah.
Because if you can enter the corners the way Mark used to do it with the Honda, then so early he does already so much turning that he doesn't need a rear end almost. He can just pick up the bike and simplify it a little bit. Now when the tires and the tire rules are there, he suffers probably more. They suffer probably more, the Honda riders.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I find it intriguing that even when they are afraid of the bike and I just wanted to survive, you know, Joan Mir Friday morning, he was just here waiting for the new Honda on Tuesday. Friday morning, first practice session, bam, off he goes, big time. It's so big that he decided, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
I call it the weekend. So you jump on the bike, a couple of riders, and you tell yourself really to do nothing special, just ride around, survive the week, and you go. That's devastating for your mind all year, because it's not just now, it's been the Honda for years. Good luck, Luca Marini.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, I always think looking at the Honda that they, you know, the big thing about the bikes now, they're getting longer, and the Honda just doesn't look long enough to me for a start. And so maybe if they put Marini on it and make it longer, it'll be better. But I think, Marini's got very long arms. He's very big, which means he's got very long arms, which means his elbows poke out a long way.
He's a spider, long legs, long arms.
Yeah, which might be very important on the Honda. He's got big fucking outriggers on his left and right elbows, you know. So my personal feeling is that it'll take Honda a long time to dig themselves out of their hole. Yamaha maybe slightly shorter, but I just really worry, you know, that they can't make enough power, and if you can't make enough power, you can't have enough aero, and if you can't have enough aero, you have more wheelie. So you not only do you have less acceleration because you haven't got the horsepower. You have less acceleration because you've got more wheelies. So it's a kind of catch-22, really. It's a bit of a worry if you work for Honda and Yamaha or Yamaha. So, yeah, but who knows?
Yeah, maybe in the end, even more for Yamaha. Yeah,
yeah.
Because they are, at the moment, faster, but they are stuck to the wall. They can't go any further. Not many people see them improving enough for next year. But at Honda, it's just more or less amazing that they are not yet there. They have it.
Yeah.
Honda get now is one of the slowest bikes on the grid. Remember Qatar, the Yamaha was overtaking, Fabio was overtaking Marc Marquez. I mean, that has never happened before, probably. Now, Honda is a pride company when it's about engines. They are a bit like Ducati. They like a lot the engine and then make a sassy around it to put the best rider they can afford on it and go to the podium.
Yeah.
Now they get beaten by every man and his dog on the streets.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's one of the many, many insults that happened to them.
Yeah,
but Luca Marini, for me, is a completely good choice. Eh? He's already not the youngest anymore. He's probably not going to do a lot of world championship. Deep inside, he realizes, but he's really intelligent. He's very fucking intelligent. So he can help them. He's like more clever Aleix Espargaró. And you know what Aleix did with Aprilia, giving a lot of good information.
Yeah, without a doubt, he's A, very intelligent, and be very articulate. He's very good at explaining things, even to journalists. So I hate to think how good he is at explaining things to engineers. So and obviously he's coming off the Ducati, and he'll be able to say, you know, the big problem with the Japanese is that, to me, is not that they lack the engineering, they need to change their culture, you know.
That's harder to do.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, your national culture comes from centuries of history, the way you do things and why you do them, and to change that, wow, you know, is not easy. So I think they have a kind of a long road ahead of them, and you know, it'll be, that's the whole point of racing. It goes up and it goes down. You have your good years, you have your bad years, but it's going to be interesting looking at them and seeing if they can say, okay, we don't just need to change the chassis or the engine, we need to change our culture, and we need to work, and to do that we need to hire some European engineers, and if we do that we probably need to
build a shop in Europe, do development in Europe.
Exactly. So it's they face a long road. I think they face a long road.
Well, it will start on Tuesday.
Yeah.
I'm gonna keep an eye on the timing screens and do some apping and texting and want to know what everybody says and what lap times everybody does and see the pictures, because it is really very interesting Tuesday Valencia. It is.
Yeah, and the good thing is the weather's going to be pretty good. I mean, there'll be a fairly short window when the track is of a decent temperature, but I'll be here. I'll be sort of elbowing other journalists out of the way, trying to get pictures of Marquez as comes out of the garage for the first time.
Nobody
will be there. It'll be like be like Rossi when he went to Ducati, you know, but except the entirely different situation. Instead of going from a good bike to a shit bike, Marc Marquez is going from a bad bike to a good bike. So it's going to be fascinating. I can't wait for Tuesday. I can't wait for not doing an awful lot tomorrow apart from writing and lying in bed and thinking about my life and stuff. So here we are. We've done four.
You're not going up and down the pit lane, Moto2, Moto3, checking for the Pirelli tires, left times?
No.
I'm so disappointed here.
No, I need a fucking day off. Thank you very much, Peter. Well, it's not a day off. I'll be
you're welcome, my friend.
By in my hotel room writing nonsense, which is what I'm good at. So I'll say goodbye to everyone.
It's a gift.
Yeah, something like that, or a curse, something like that. So thanks to everybody for listening to our 40-minute final MotoGP race special. Thanks, Peter, for the whole season. It's been great. And we're going to be here every Sunday all through the winter, whether you like it or not, starting next week with an in-depth analysis of what went on at Valencia on Tuesday. So thanks as always to Peter, thanks to Sam, our producer, and thanks to myself. I suppose I can say that, can I? I don't know, really.
I think so.
And thanks to all our listeners for listening as always, and we'll speak to you next week. Many thanks. Happy Christmas.